and then when you did, mostly they had hair that needed washing that night, or diaries to update, or cockatiels to groom, or they simply needed to wait by the phone for some other man not to call. But Spider lived in a different world. They wandered toward the West End, stopping when they reached a crowded pub. The patrons spilled out onto the pavement, and Spider stopped and said hello to what turned out to be a birthday celebration for a young lady named Sibylla, who was only too flattered when Spider insisted on buying a birthday round of drinks for her and for her friends. Then he told jokes.
"And the duck says, 'Put it on my bill. What do you think I am, some kind of pervert?' And he laughed at his own jokes, a booming, joyful laugh.
He could remember the names of all the people around him. He talked to people and listened to what they said. When Spider announced it was time to find another pub, the entire birthday group decided, as one woman, that they were coming with him. By the time they reached their third pub, Spider resembled someone from a rock video. He was draped with girls. They snuggled in. Several of them had kissed him, half-joking, half-seriously. Fat Charlie watched in envious horror.
"You his bodyguard?" asked one of the girls.
"What?"
"His bodyguard. Are you?"
"No," said Fat Charlie. "I'm his brother."
"Wow," she said. "I didn't know he had a brother. I think he's amazing."
"Me too,"
said another, who had spent some time cuddling Spider, until forced away by the press of other bodies with similar ideas. She noticed Fat Charlie for the first time.
"Are you his manager?"
"No, he's the brother,"
said the first girl.
"He was just telling me," she added pointedly.
The second ignored her.
"Are you from the States as well?" she asked. "You've sort of got a bit of an accent."
"When I was younger," said Fat Charlie, "we lived in Florida. My dad was American. My mum was from... well, she was originally from St. Andrews, but she grew up in..." Nobody was listening. When they moved on from there, the remnants of the birthday celebration accompanied them. The women surrounded Spider, inquiring where they were going next. Restaurants were suggested, as were nightclubs. Spider simply grinned and kept walking. Fat Charlie trailed along behind them, feeling more left out than ever. They stumbled through the neon and strip-light world. Spider had his arms around several of the women. He would kiss them as he walked, indiscriminately, like a man taking a bite from first one summer fruit, then another. None of them seemed to mind. "It's not normal," thought Fat Charlie. "That's what it's not." He was not even trying to keep up, merely attempting not to be left behind. He could still taste the bitter wine on his tongue. He became aware that a girl was walking along beside him. She was small and pretty, in a pixie-ish sort of way. She tugged at his sleeve.
"What are we doing?" she asked. "Where are we going?"
"We're mourning my father," he said. "I think."
"Is it a reality TV show?"
"I hope not." Spider stopped and turned. The gleam in his eyes was disturbing. "We are here," he announced. "We have arrived. It is what he would have wanted." There was a handwritten message on a sheet of bright orange paper on the door outside the pub. It said on it, "Tonight, upstairs, karaoke." "Song," said Spider. Then he said, "It's showtime."
"No," said Fat Charlie. He stopped where he was.
"It's what he loved," said Spider.
"I don't sing, not in public, and I'm drunk, and I really don't think this is a really good idea."
"It's a great idea."
Spider had a perfectly convincing smile. Properly deployed, a smile like that could launch a holy war. Fat Charlie, however, was not convinced.
"Look," he said, trying to keep the panic from his voice, "there are things that people don't do, right? Some people don't fly. Some people don't have sex in public. Some people don't turn into smoke and blow away. I don't do any of those things, and I don't sing either."
"Not even for Dad?"
"Especially not for Dad. He's not going to embarrass me from beyond the grave. Well, not any more than he has already."
"Excuse me," said one of the young women. "Excuse me, but are we going in? 'Cause I'm getting cold out here and Sibylla needs a wee."
"We're going in," said Spider, and he smiled at her.
Fat Charlie wanted to protest, to stand his ground, but he found himself swept inside, hating himself. He caught up with Spider on the stairs.
"I'll go in," he said, "but I won't sing."
"You're already in."
"I know, but I'm not singing."
"Not much point in saying you won't go in if you're already in."
"I can't sing."
"You telling me I inherited all the musical talent as well?"
"I'm telling you that if I have to open my mouth in order to sing in public, I'll throw up."
Spider squeezed his arm reassuringly. You watch how I do it, he said.
The birthday girl and two of her friends stumbled up onto the little dais and giggled their way through Dancing Queen. Fat Charlie drank a gin and tonic somebody had put into his hand, and he winced at every note they missed, at every key change that didn't happen. There was a round of applause from the rest of the birthday group. Another of the women took the stage. It was the pixie-ish one, who had asked Fat Charlie where they were going. The opening chord sounded to Stand By Me, and she began, using the phrase in its most approximate and all-encompassing way, to sing along. She missed every note, came in too soon or too late on every line, and misread most of them. Fat Charlie felt for her. She climbed down from the stage and came toward the bar. Fat Charlie was going to say something sympathetic, but she was glowing with joy.
"That was so great," she said. "I mean, that was just amazing."
Fat Charlie brought her a drink, a large vodka and orange.
"That was such a laugh," she told him. "Are you going to do it? Go on. You have to do it. I'll bet you won't be any crapper than I was."
Fat Charlie shrugged, in a way that he hoped indicated that he contained within him depths of crap as yet unplumbed. Spider walked over to the little stage as if a spotlight was following him.
"I'll bet this'll be good," said the vodka and orange. "Did someone say you were his brother?"
"No," muttered Fat Charlie ungraciously. "I said that he was my brother." Spider began to sing. It was Under the Boardwalk. It wouldn't have happened if Fat Charlie had not liked the song so much. When Fat Charlie was 13, he had believed that Under the Boardwalk was the greatest song in the world. By the time he was a jaded and world-weary 14-year-old, it had become Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry. And now Spider was singing his song, and singing it well. He sang it in tune. He sang it as if he meant it. People stopped drinking, stopped talking, and they looked at him, and they listened. When Spider finished singing, people cheered. Had they been wearing hats, they might well have flung them into the air.
"I can see why you wouldn't want to follow that," said the vodka and orange to Fat Charlie. "I mean, you can't follow that, can you?"
"Well," said Fat Charlie.
"I mean," she said with a grin, "you can see who's got all the talent in your family."
She tipped her head as she said it and tilted her chin. It was the chin tilt that did it. Fat Charlie headed toward the stage, putting one foot in front of the other in an impressive display of physical dexterity. He was sweating. The next few minutes passed in a blur. He spoke to the DJ, chose his song from the list, unforgettable, waited for what seemed like a brief eternity, and was handed a microphone. His mouth was dry. His heart was fluttering in his chest. On the screen was his first word, unforgettable. Now, Fat Charlie could really sing. He had range and power and expression. When he sang, his whole body became an instrument. The music started. In Fat Charlie's head, he was all ready to open his mouth and to sing. Unforgettable, he would sing, and he would sing it to his dead father and to his brother and the night. Only, he couldn't do it. There were people looking up at him. Barely 2 dozen of them, in the upstairs room of a pub. Many of them were women. In front of an audience, Fat Charlie couldn't even open his mouth. He could hear the music playing, but he just stood there. He felt very cold. His feet seemed a long way away. He forced his mouth open. "I think," he said, very distinctly, into the microphone over the music, and heard his words echoing back from every corner of the room. "I think I'm going to be sick." There was no graceful exit from the stage. After that, everything got a bit wobbly. There are myth places. They exist, each in their own way. Some of them are overlaid on the world. Others exist beneath the world as it is, like an underpainting. There are mountains. They are the rocky places you will reach before you come to the cliffs that border the end of the world, and there are caves in those mountains, deep caves that were inhabited long before the first men walked the earth. They are inhabited still. Chapter 5, in which we examine the many consequences of the morning after. Fat Charlie was thirsty. Fat Charlie was thirsty and his head hurt.
Fat Charlie was thirsty, and his head hurt, and his mouth tasted evil, and his eyes were too tight in his head, and all his teeth twinged, and his stomach burned, and his back was aching in a way that started around his knees and went up to his forehead, and his brains had been removed and replaced with cotton balls and needles and pins, which was white hurt to try and think. And his eyes were not just too tight in his head, but they must have rolled out in the night and been reattached with roofing nails. And now he noticed that anything louder than the gentle brownian motion of air molecules drifting softly past each other was above his pain threshold. Also, he wished he were dead. Fat Charlie opened his eyes, which was a mistake, in that it let daylight in, which hurt. It also told him where he was, in his own bed, in his bedroom, and because he was staring at the clock on his bedside table, it told him that the time was 11:30. That, he thought, one word at a time, was about as bad as things could get. He had the kind of hangover that an Old Testament god might have smitten the Midianites with, and the next time he saw Graham Coates, he would undoubtedly learn that he had been fired. He wondered if he could sound convincingly sick over the phone, then realized that the challenge would be convincingly sounding anything else. He could not remember getting home last night. He would phone the office the moment he was able to remember the telephone number. He would apologize. Crippling 24-hour flu, flat on his back, nothing that could be done.
"You know," said someone in the bed next to him, "I think there's a bottle of water on your side. Could you pass it over here?"
Fat Charlie wanted to explain that there was no water on his side of the bed, and that there was, in fact, no water closer than the bathroom sink, if he disinfected the toothbrush mug first, but he realized he was staring at one of several bottles of water sitting on the bedside table. He reached his hand out and closed fingers that felt like they belonged to someone else around one of them. Then, with the sort of effort people usually reserve for hauling themselves up the final few feet of a sheer rock face, he rolled over in bed. It was the vodka and orange. Also, she was naked, at least the bits of her he could see were. She took the water and pulled the sheet up to cover her chest.
"Tar, he said to tell you," she said, "when you woke, not to worry about calling work and telling them you were ill. He said to tell you he's already taken care of it."
Fat Charlie's mind was not put at rest. His fears and worries were not allayed. Then again, in the condition he was in, he only had room in his head for a single thing to worry about at once, and right now he was worrying about whether or not he would make it to the bathroom in time.
"You'll need more liquids," said the girl. "You'll need to replenish your electrolytes."
Fat Charlie made it to the bathroom in time. Afterward, seeing he was there already, he stood under the shower until the room stopped undulating, and then he brushed his teeth without throwing up. When he returned to the bedroom, the vodka and orange was no longer there, which was a relief to Fat Charlie, who had started to hope that she might have been an alcohol-induced delusion, like Pink Elephants or the nightmarish idea that he had taken to the stage to sing on the previous evening. He could not find his dressing gown, so he pulled on a tracksuit, in order to feel dressed enough to visit the kitchen at the far end of the hall. His phone chimed, and he rummaged through his jacket, which was on the floor beside the bed, until he found it and flipped it open. He grunted into it, as anonymously as he could, just in case it was someone from the Graham Coates agency trying to discern his whereabouts.
"It's me," said Spider's voice. "Everything's okay."
"You told them I was dead."
"Better than that. I told them I was you."
"But..." Fat Charlie tried to think clearly.
"But you're not me."
"Hey, I know that. I told them I was."
"You don't even look like me."
"Brother of mine, you are harshing a potential mellow here. It's all taken care of. Oops, gotta go. The big boss needs to talk to me."
"Graham Coates! Look, Spider!"
But Spider had put down the phone, and the screen blanked. Fat Charlie's dressing gown came through the door. There was a girl inside it. It looked significantly better on her than it ever had on him. She was carrying a tray on which was a water glass with a fizzing Alka-Seltzer in it, along with something in a mug.
"Drink both of these," she told him. "The mug first. Just knock it back."
"What's in the mug?"
"Egg yolk, Worcester sauce, Tabasco, salt, dash of vodka, things like that," she said. "Kill or cure. Now," she told him, in tones that brook no argument, "drink."
Fat Charlie drank.
"Oh, my God," he said.
"Yeah," she agreed, "but you're still alive."
He wasn't sure about that. He drank the Alka-Seltzer anyway. Something occurred to him.
said Fat Charlie. Look, last night, did we, She looked blank.
Did we what?
Did we, you know, do it?
You mean you don't remember?
Her face fell.
You said it was the best you'd ever had, that it was as if you'd never made love to a woman before. You were part god, part animal, and part unstoppable sex machine.
Fat Charlie didn't know where to look. She giggled.
I'm just winding you up, she said. I'd helped your brother get you home. We cleaned you up, and after that, you know.
No, he said. I don't know.
Well, she said, you were completely out cold, and it's a big bed. I'm not sure where your brother slept. He must have the constitution of an ox. He was up at the crack of dawn, all bright and smiling.
He went into work, said Fat Charlie. He told them he was me.
Wouldn't they be able to tell the difference? I mean, you're not exactly twins.
Apparently not, he shook his head. Then he looked at her. She stuck out a small, extremely pink tongue at him. What's your name?
You mean you've forgotten? I remember your name. You're Fat Charlie.
Charles, he said. Just Charles is fine.
I'm Daisy, she said, and stuck out her hand. Pleased to meet you.
They shook hands solemnly. I feel a bit better, said Fat Charlie.
Like I said, she said. Kill or cure.
Spider was having a great day at the office. He almost never worked in offices. He almost never worked. Everything was new, everything was marvellous and strange, from the tiny lift that lurched him up to the fifth floor, to the Warren-like offices of the Graham Coates Agency. He stared fascinated at the glass case in the lobby filled with dusty awards. He wandered through the offices, and when anyone asked him who he was, he would say, "I'm Fat Charlie Nancy," and he'd say it in his god voice, which would make whatever he said practically true. He found the tea room, and made himself several cups of tea. Then he carried them back to Fat Charlie's desk, and arranged them around it in an artistic fashion. He started to play with the computer network. It asked him for a password. "I'm Fat Charlie Nancy," he told the computer, but there were still places it didn't want him to go, so he said, "I'm Graham Coates," and it opened to him like a flower. He looked at things on the computer until he got bored. He dealt with the contents of Fat Charlie's in-basket. He dealt with Fat Charlie's pending basket. It occurred to him that Fat Charlie would be waking up around now, so he called him at home in order to reassure him. He just felt that he was making a little headway when Graham Coates put his head round the door, ran his fingers across his stoat-like lips, and beckoned.
"Gotta go," Spider said to his brother. "The big boss needs to talk to me."
He put down the phone.
"Making private phone calls on company time, Nancy," stated Graham Coates.
"Abso-friggin-lutely," agreed Spider.
"And was that myself you were referring to as the big boss?" asked Graham Coates.
They walked to the end of the hallway and into his office.
"You're the biggest," said Spider, "and the bossest."
Graham Coates looked puzzled. He suspected he was being made fun of, but he was not certain, and this disturbed him.
"Well, sit ye down," he said.
Spider sat him down.
It was Graham Coates's custom to keep the turnover of staff at the Graham Coates Agency fairly constant. Some people came and went. Others came and remained until just before their jobs would begin to carry some kind of employment protection. Fat Charlie had been there longer than anyone. 1 year and 11 months. 1 month to go before redundancy payments or industrial tribunals could become a part of his life. There was a speech that Graham Coates gave before he fired someone. He was very proud of his speech.
"Into each life," he began, "a little rain must fall. There's no cloud without a silver lining."
"It's a ill wind," offered Spider, "that blows no one good."
"Ah, yes, yes, indeed. Well, as we pass through this vale of tears, we must pause to reflect that..."
"The first cut," said Spider, "is the deepest."
"What? Oh," Graham Coates scrabbled to remember what came next. "Happiness," he pronounced, "is like a butterfly."
"Or a bluebird," agreed Spider.
"Quite, if I may finish."
"Of course, be my guest," said Spider cheerfully.
"And the happiness of every soul at the Graham Coates Agency is as important to me as my own."
"I cannot tell you," said Spider, "how happy that makes me."
"Yes," said Graham Coates.
"Well, I better get back to work," said Spider. "It's been a blast, though. Next time you want to share some more, just call me. You know where I am."
"Happiness?"
said Graham Coates, his voice taking on a faintly strangulated quality. "And what I wonder, Nancy Charles, is this. Are you happy here? And do you not agree that you might be rather happier elsewhere?"
"That's not what I wonder," said Spidey. "You want to know what I wonder?"
Graham Coates said nothing. It had never gone like this before. Normally, at this point, their faces fell and they went into shock. Sometimes they cried. Graham Coates had never minded when they cried.
"What I wonder," said Spider, "is what the accounts in the Cayman Islands are for. You know, because it almost sort of looks like money that should go to our client accounts sometimes just goes into the Cayman Islands accounts instead, and it seems a funny sort of way to organize the finances, for the money coming into rest in those accounts. I've never seen anything like it before. I was hoping you could explain it to me."
Graham Coates had gone off-white. One of those colors that turn up in paint catalogs with names like parchment or magnolia. He said, "How did you get access to those accounts?"
"Computers," said Spider. "Do they drive you as nuts as they drive me? What can you do?"
Graham Coates thought for several long moments. He had always liked to imagine that his financial affairs were so deeply tangled that even if the fraud squad were ever able to conclude that financial crimes had been committed, they would find it extremely difficult to explain to a jury exactly what kind of crimes they were.
"There's nothing illegal about having offshore accounts," he said as carelessly as possible.
"Illegal?" said Spider. "I should hope not. I mean, if I saw anything illegal, I should have to report it to the appropriate authorities."
Graham Coates picked up a pen from his desk. Then he put it down again.
"Ah," he said, "well, delightful though it is to chat, converse, spend time and otherwise hobnob with you, Charles. I suspect that both of us have work we should be getting on with. Time and tide, after all, wait for no man. Procrastination is the thief of time."
"Life is a rock," suggested Spider, "but the radio rolled me."
"Whatever."
Fat Charlie was starting to feel human again. He was no longer in pain. Slow, intimate waves of nausea were no longer sweeping over him. While he was not yet convinced that the world was a fine and joyous place, he was no longer in the ninth circle of hangover hell, and this was a good thing. Daisy had taken over the bathroom. He had listened to the taps running, and then to some contented splashes. He knocked on the bathroom door.
"I'm in here," said Daisy. "I'm in the bath."
"I know," said Fat Charlie. "I mean, I didn't know, but I thought you probably were."
"Yes?" said Daisy.
"I just wondered," he said through the door. "I wondered why you came back here. Last night."
"Well," she said, "you were a bit the worse for wear, and your brother looked like he needed a hand. I'm not working this morning, so voila."
"Voila," said Fat Charlie. On the one hand, she felt sorry for him, and on the other, she really liked Spider. Yes, he'd only had a brother for a little over a day, and already he felt there would be no surprises left in this new family relationship. Spider was the cool one, he was the other one.
She said, "You have a lovely voice."
"What?"
"You were singing in the taxi, when we were going home. Unforgettable. It was lovely."
He had somehow put the karaoke incident out of his mind, placed it in the dark places one disposes of inconvenient things. Now it came back, and he wished it hadn't.
"You were great," she said. "Will you sing to me, later?"
Fat Charlie thought desperately, and then was saved from thinking desperately by the doorbell. "Someone at the door," he said. He went downstairs and opened the door, and things got worse. Rose's mother gave him a look that would have curdled milk. She said nothing. She was holding a large white envelope.
"Hello," said Fat Charlie. "Mrs. Noah, nice to see you.
She sniffed and held the envelope in front of her.
"Oh," she said, "you're here. So you're going to invite me in?"
"That's right," thought Fat Charlie. "Your kind always have to be invited. Just say no, and she'll have to go away. Of course, Mrs. Noah, please come in." So that's how vampires do it. "Would you like a cup of tea?"
"Don't think you can get round me like that," she said, "because you can't."
Right. Up the narrow stairs and into the kitchen, Rose's mother looked around and made a face as if to indicate that it did not meet her standards of hygiene, containing, as it did, edible foodstuffs.
"Coffee? Water?
Don't say wax fruit."
"Wax fruit?
Damn."
"I understand from Rosie that your father recently passed away," she said.
"Yes, he did."
"When Rosie's father passed, they did a 4-page obituary in Cooks and Cookery.
They said he was solely responsible for the arrival of Caribbean fusion cuisine in this country.
Oh, he said.
It's not like he left me badly off, neither. He had life insurance, and he owned a share of 2 successful restaurants. I'm a very well-off woman. When I die, it will all go to Rosie.
When we're married, said Fat Charlie, I'll be looking after her. Don't you worry.
I'm not saying you're only after Rosie for my money, said Rosie's mother in a tone of voice that made it clear that that was exactly what she did believe.
Fat Charlie's headache started coming back.
Mrs. Noah, is there anything I can help you with? I've been talking to Rosie, and we've decided that I should start helping with your wedding plans, she said primly. I need a list of your relations and friends, the ones you are hoping to invite. Names, addresses, email, and phone numbers. I've made a form for you to fill out. I thought I'd save on postage and drop it off myself, since I was going to be passing by Maxwell Gardens anyway. I was not expecting to find you home.
She handed him the large white envelope.
There will be a total of 90 people at the wedding. You will be permitted a total of 8 family members and 6 personal friends. The personal friends and 4 family members will comprise table H. The rest of your group will be at table C. Your father would have been seated with us at the head table, but seeing that he has passed over, we have allocated his seat to Rose's Aunt Winifred. Have you decided on your best man yet?
Fat Charlie shook his head.
Well, when you do, make certain he knows that there won't be any crude stuff in his speech. I don't want to hear nothing from your best man I wouldn't hear in a church. You understand me?
Fat Charlie wondered what Rosie's mother would usually hear in a church. Probably just cries of, "Back, foul beast of hell!" followed by gasps of, "Is it alive?" and a nervous inquiry as to whether anybody had remembered to bring the stakes and hammers.
"I think," said Fat Charlie, "I have more than 10 relations. I mean, there are cousins and great-aunts and things." "What you obviously fail to grasp," said Rosie's mother, "is that weddings cost money. I've allocated £175 a person to tables A to D. Table A is the head table, which takes care of Rosie's closest relations and my woman's club. And £125 to tables E to G, which are, you know, more distant acquaintances, the children, and so on and so forth."
"You said my friends will be at table H," said Fat Charlie.
"That's the next tier down. They won't be getting the avocado shrimp starters or the sherry trifle."
"When Rosie and I talked about it last, we thought we'd be going for a sort of general West Indian theme to the food." Rosie's mother sniffed.
"She sometimes doesn't know her own mind, that girl, but she and I are now in full agreement."
"Look," said Fat Charlie, "I think maybe I ought to talk to Rosie about all this and get back to you."
"Just fill out the forms," said Rosie's mother.
Then she said suspiciously,
"Why aren't you at work?"
I'm not in. That is to say, I'm off this morning. Not going in today. Not.
"I hope you told Rosie that. She was planning to see you for lunch. She told me. That was why she could not have lunch with me."
Fat Charlie took this information in. "Right," he said. "Well, thanks for popping over, Mrs. Noah. I'll talk to Rosie and..." Daisy came into the kitchen. She wore a towel wrapped around her head and Fat Charlie's dressing gown, which clung to her damp body. She said,
"There's orange juice, isn't there? I know I saw some when I was poking around before. How's your head? Any better?"
She opened the fridge door and poured herself a tall glass of orange juice. Rosie's mother cleared her throat. It did not sound like a throat being cleared. It sounded like pebbles rattling down a beach.
"Hello," said Daisy. "I'm Daisy."
The temperature in the kitchen began to drop.
"Indeed," said Rosie's mother.
Icicles hung from the final D.
"I wonder what they would have called oranges," said Fat Charlie into the silence, "if they weren't orange. I mean, if there were some previously unknown blue fruit, would they have been called blues? Would we be drinking blue juice?"
"What?" asked Rosie's mother.
"Bless you, she'd hear the things that come out of your mouth," said Daisy cheerfully. "Right, I'm going to see if I can find my clothes. Lovely meeting you."
She went out. Fat Charlie did not resume breathing.
"Who," said Rosie's mother perfectly calmly, "was that?"
My cousin, said Fat Charlie. "I'll just think of her as my sister. We were very close growing up. She just decided to crash here last night. She's a bit of a wild child." "Well, yes, you'll see her at the wedding."
"I'll put her down for table H," said Rosie's mother. "She'll be more comfortable there."
She said it in the same way most people would say things like, "Do you wish to die quickly, or shall I let Mungo have his fun first?"
"Right," said Fat Charlie. "Well," he said, "lovely to see you." "Well," he said,
"You must have lots of things to be getting on with, and," he said, "I need to be getting to work."
"I thought you had the day off."
"Morning. I've got the morning off, and it's nearly over, and I should be getting off to work now, so goodbye." She clutched her handbag to her, and she stood up. Fat Charlie followed her out into the hall. "Lovely seeing you," he said. She blinked, as a nictitating python might blink before striking.
"Goodbye, Daisy," she called. "I'll see you at the wedding."
Daisy, now wearing panties and a bra, and in the process of pulling on a T-shirt, leaned out into the hall.
"Take care,"
she said, and went back into Fat Charlie's bedroom. Rosie's mother said nothing else as Fat Charlie led her down the stairs. He opened the door for her, and as she went past him, he saw on her face something terrible, something that made his stomach knot more than it was knotting already. The thing that Rosie's mother was doing with her mouth. It was pulled up at the corners in a ghastly rictus, like a skull with lips. Rosie's mother was smiling. He closed the door behind her, and he stood and shivered in the downstairs hall. Then, like a man going to the electric chair, he went back up the hall steps.
"Who was that?"
asked Daisy, who was now almost dressed. "My fiancé's mother.
She's a real bundle of joy, isn't she?"
She dressed in the same clothes she had worn the previous night. "You going to work like that?"
"Oh, bless. No, I'll go home and change. This isn't how I look at work anyway. Can you ring a taxi?"
"Where you headed?"
"Hendon."
He called a local taxi service. Then he sat on the floor in the hallway and contemplated various future scenarios, all of them uncontemplatable. Someone was standing next to him.
"I've got some B vitamins in my bag," she said. "Or you could try sucking on a spoonful of honey. It's never done anything for me, but my flatmate swears by it for hangovers."
"It's not that," said Fat Charlie. "I told her you were my cousin, so she wouldn't think you were my... that we, you know, a strange girl in the apartment, all that."
"Cousin, is it? Well, not to worry. She'll probably forget all about me. And if she doesn't, tell her I left the country mysteriously. You'll never see me again."
"Really?
Promise. You don't have to sound so pleased about it."
A car horn sounded in the street outside.
"That'll be my taxi. Stand up and say goodbye."
He stood up.
"Not to worry," she said.
She hugged him. "I think my life is over," he said.
"No, it's not."
"I'm doomed."
"Thanks," she said.
She leaned up, and she kissed him on the lips, longer and harder than can possibly fit within the bounds of recent introduction. Then she smiled, and walked jauntily down the stairs, and let herself out.
"This," said Fat Charlie out loud when the door closed, "probably isn't really happening."
He could still taste her on his lips, all orange juice and raspberries. That was a kiss. That was a serious kiss. There was an oomph behind that kiss that he had never in his whole life had before, not even from... "Rosie," he said. He flipped open his phone and speed dialed her.
"This is Rosie's phone," said Rosie's voice. "I'm busy, or I've lost the phone again, and you're in voicemail. Try me at home or leave me a message."
Fat Charlie closed the phone. Then he put on his coat over his tracksuit, and, wincing just a little at the terrible, unblinking daylight, he went out into the street. Rosie Noah was worried, which in itself worried her. It was, as so many things in Rosie's world were, whether she would admit it to herself or not, Rosie's mother's fault. Rosie had become quite used to a world in which her mother hated the idea of her marrying Fat Charlie Nancy. She took her mother's opposition to the marriage as a sign from the heavens that she was probably doing something right, even when she was not entirely sure in her own mind that this was actually the case. And she loved him, of course. He was solid, reassuring, sane. Her mother's about turn on the matter of Fat Charlie had Rosie worried, and her mother's sudden enthusiasm for wedding organization troubled her deeply. She had phoned Fat Charlie the previous night to discuss the matter, but he was not answering his phones. Rosie thought perhaps he had had an early night. It was why she was giving up her lunchtime to talk to him. The Graham Coates Agency occupied the top floor of a grey Victorian building in the Aldwych, and was at the top of 5 flights of stairs. There was a lift, though, which had been installed 100 years before by theatrical agent Rupert Binky Butterworth. It was an extremely small, slow, juddery lift, whose design and function peculiarities only became comprehensible when you discovered that Binky Butterworth had possessed the size, shape, and ability to squeeze into small spaces of a portly young hippopotamus, and had designed the lift to fit, at a squeeze, Binky Butterworth and one other, much slimmer person. A chorus girl, for example, or a chorus boy. Binky was not picky. All it took to make Binky happy was someone seeking theatrical representation squeezed into the lift with him, and a very slow and juddery journey up all 6 stories to the top. It was often the case that by the time he reached the top floor, Binky would be so overcome by the pressures of the journey that he would need to go and have a little lie down, leaving the chorus girl or chorus boy to cool his or her heels in the waiting room, concerned that the red-faced, panting and uncontrolled gasping for breath that Binky had been suffering from as they reached the final floors meant that he had been having some kind of early Edwardian embolism. People would go into the lift with Binky Butterworth once, but after that, they used the stairs. Graham Coates, who had purchased the remains of the Butterworth Agency from Binky's granddaughter more than 20 years before, maintained the lift was part of history. Rosie slammed the inner accordion door, closed the outer door, and went into reception, where she told the receptionist she wanted to see Charles Nancy. She sat down, beneath the photographs of Graham Coates with people he had represented. She recognized Morris Livingston, the comedian, some once famous boy bands, and a clutch of sports stars who had, in their later years, become personalities, the kind who got as much fun out of life as they could until a new liver became available. A man came into reception. He did not look much like Fat Charlie. He was darker, and he was smiling as if he were amused by everything. Deeply, dangerously amused. "I'm Fat Charlie Nancy," said the man. Rosie walked over to Fat Charlie and gave him a peck on the cheek. He said, "Do I know you?" Which was an odd thing to say. And then he said, "Of course I do. You're Rosie, and you get more beautiful every day." And he kissed her in return, touching his lips to hers. Their lips only brushed, but Rosie's heart began to beat like Binky Butterworth's after a particularly juddery lift journey pressed up against a Coreen.
"Lunch," squeaked Rosie. "Passing. Thought maybe we could talk."
"Yeah," said the man who Rosie now thought of as Fat Charlie. "Lunch." He put a comfortable arm around Rosie. "Anywhere you want to go for lunch?"
"Oh," she said, "just wherever you want."
It was the way he smelled, she thought. Why had she never before noticed how much he liked the way he smelled? "We'll find somewhere," he said. "Shall we take the stairs?"
"If it's all the same to you," she said, "I think I'd rather take the lift."
She banged home the accordion door, and they rode down to street level slowly and shakily, pressed up against each other. Rosie couldn't remember the last time she'd been so happy. When they got out onto the street, Rosie's phone beeped to let her know she'd missed a call. She ignored it. They went into the first restaurant they came to. Until the previous month, it had been a high-tech sushi restaurant with a conveyor belt that ran around the room carrying small, raw, fishy nibbles, priced according to plate color. The Japanese restaurant had gone out of business and had been instantly replaced, in the way of London restaurants, by a Hungarian restaurant, which had kept the conveyor belt as a high-tech addition to the world of Hungarian cuisine, which meant that rapidly cooling bowls of goulash, paprika dumplings, and pots of sour cream made their way in stately fashion around the room. Rosie didn't think it was going to catch on.
"Where were you last night?" she asked.
"I went out," he said, "with my brother."
"You're an only child," she said.
"I'm not. It turns out I'm half of a matched set."
"Really? Is this more of your dad's legacy?"
"Honey," said the man she thought of as Fat Charlie, "you don't know the half of it."
"Well," she said, "I hope he'll be coming to the wedding."
"I don't believe he would miss it for the world." He closed his hand around hers, and she nearly dropped her goulash spoon. "What are you doing for the rest of the afternoon?"
"Not much. Things are practically dead back at the office right now. Couple of fundraising phone calls to make, but they can wait. Is there, were you, why?"
"It's such a beautiful day. Do you want to go for a walk?"
"That," said Rosie, "would be quite lovely."
They wandered down to the embankment and began to walk along the northern bank of the Thames, a slow, hand-in-hand amble, talking about nothing much in particular.
"What about your work?"
asked Rosie when they stopped to buy an ice cream. "Oh," he said, "they won't mind. They probably won't even notice that I'm not there." Fat Charlie ran up the stairs to the Graham Coates agency. He always took the stairs. It was healthier for a start, and it meant he would never again have to worry about finding himself wedged into the lift with someone else, too close to pretend they weren't there. He walked into reception, panting slightly.
"Has Rosie been in, Annie?"
"Did you lose her?"
said the receptionist. He walked back to his office. His desk was peculiarly tidy. The clutter of undealt-with correspondence was gone. There was a yellow post-it note on his computer screen with "See Me, GC" on it. He knocked on Graham Coates' office door. This time a voice said, "Yes?"
"It's me," he said.
"Yes," said Graham Coates. "Come ye in, Master Nancy, pull up a pew. I've been giving our conversation of this morning a great deal of thought, and it seems to me that I have misjudged you. You have been working here for how long?"
"Nearly 2 years."
"You have been working long and hard, and now your father's sad passing..."
"Oh, I didn't really know him."
"Ah, brave soul, Nancy. Given that it is currently the fallow season, how would you react to an offer of a couple of weeks off, with, I hardly need to add, full pay?"
"Full pay?" said Fat Charlie.
"Full pay, but yes. I see your point. Spending money. I'm sure you could do with a little spending money, couldn't you?"
Fat Charlie tried to work out what universe he was in. "Am I being fired?"
Graham Coates laughed then, like a weasel with a sharp bone stuck in its throat. "Absolutely not. Quite the reverse. In fact, I believe," he said, "that we now understand each other perfectly. Your job is safe and sound, safe as houses, as long as you remain the model of circumspection and discretion you have been so far."
"How safe are houses?" asked Fat Charlie.
"Extremely safe."
"It's just that I read somewhere that most accidents occur in the home."
"Then," said Graham Coates, "I think it vitally important that you are encouraged to return to your own house with all celerity."
He handed Fat Charlie a piece of rectangular paper.
"Here," he said, "a small thank you for 2 years of devoted service to the Graham Coates Agency.
Then," because it was what he always said when he gave people money,
"don't spend it all at once."
Fat Charlie looked at the piece of paper. It was a cheque.
£2,000? Gosh, I mean... I won't."
Graham Coates smiled at Fat Charlie. If there was triumph in that smile, Fat Charlie was too puzzled, too shaken, too bemused to see it.
"Go well," said Graham Coates.
Fat Charlie went back to his office.
Graham Coates leaned around the door, casually, like a mongoose leaning idly against a snake den. "An idle question. If, while you were off enjoying yourself and relaxing, a course of action I cannot press upon you strongly enough, if, during this time, I should need to access your files, could you let me know your password?"
"I think your password should get you anywhere in the system," said Fat Charlie.
"Without doubt it will," agreed Graham Coates blithely. "But just in case, you know, computers, after all..."
"It's Mermaid," said Fat Charlie. "M-E-R-M-A-I-D.
"Excellent," said Graham Coates. "Excellent."
He didn't rub his hands together, but he might as well have done. Fat Charlie walked down the stairs with a cheque for £2,000 in his pocket, wondering how he could have so misjudged Graham Coates for the last 2 years. He walked around the corner to his bank and deposited the cheque into his account. Then he walked down to the embankment to breathe and to think. He was £2,000 richer. His headache of this morning had completely gone. He was feeling solid and prosperous. He wondered if he could talk Rosie into coming on a short holiday with him. It was short notice, but still... And then he saw Spider and Rosie walking hand in hand on the other side of the road. Rosie was finishing an ice cream. Then she stopped and dropped the remainder of the ice cream into a bin and pulled Spider toward her and, with an ice cream in mouth, began to kiss him with enthusiasm and gusto. Fat Charlie could feel his headache coming back. He felt paralyzed. He watched them kissing. He was of the opinion that sooner or later they would have to come up for air, but they didn't. So he walked in the other direction, feeling miserable, until he reached the tube, and he went home. By the time he got home, Fat Charlie felt pretty wretched, so he got onto a bed that still smelled faintly of Daisy, and he closed his eyes. Time passed, and now Fat Charlie was walking along a sandy beach with his father. They were barefoot, he was a kid again, and his father was ageless.
"So," his father was saying, "how are you and Spider getting on?"
"This is a dream," pointed out Fat Charlie, "and I don't want to talk about it."
"You boys," said his father, shaking his head, "listen, I'm going to tell you something important."
"What?" But his father did not answer. Something on the edge of the waves had caught his eye, and he reached down and picked it up. 5 pointed legs flexed languidly.
"Starfish," said his father, musing. "When you cut one in half, they just grow into 2 new starfish."
"I thought you said you were going to tell me something important." His father clutched his chest, and he collapsed onto the sand and stopped moving. Worms came out of the sand and devoured him in moments, leaving nothing but bones.
Dad?
Fat Charlie woke up in his bedroom with his cheeks wet with tears. Then he stopped crying. He had nothing to be upset about. His father had not died. It had simply been a bad dream. He decided that he would invite Rosie over tomorrow night. They would have steak. He would cook. All would be well. He got up and got dressed. He was in the kitchen 20 minutes later, spooning down a pot noodle, when it occurred to him that, although what had happened on the beach had been a dream, his father was still dead. Rosie stopped in at her mother's flat in Wimpole Street late that afternoon.
"I saw your boyfriend today," said Mrs. Noah.
Her given name had been Eutheria, but in 3 decades nobody had used it to her face but her late husband, and following his death it had atrophied and was unlikely to be used again in her lifetime.
"So did I," said Rosie. "My God, I love that man." "Well, of course. You're marrying him, aren't you?" "Well, yes, I mean, I always knew I loved him, but today I really saw how much I loved him. Everything about him."
"Did you find out where he was last night?"
"Yes. He explained it all. He was out with his brother."
"I didn't know he had a brother."
"He hadn't mentioned him before. They aren't very close."
Rosie's mother clicked her tongue.
"Must be quite a family reunion going on. Did he mention his cousin too?"
"Cousin?
Or maybe his sister. He didn't seem entirely sure. Pretty thing in a trashy sort of way. Looked a bit Chinese. No better than she should be if you ask me, but that's that whole family for you."
"Mum, you haven't met his family."
"I met her. She was in his kitchen this morning, walking about that place damn near naked. Shameless. If she was his cousin."
"Fat Charlie wouldn't lie."
"He's a man, isn't he?"
"Mum!"
"And why wasn't he at work today, anyway?"
"He was. He was at work today. We had lunch together."
Rosie's mother examined her lipstick in a pocket mirror, then with her forefinger rubbed the scarlet smudges off her teeth.
"What else did you say to him?"
asked Rosie.
"We just talked about the wedding. How I didn't want his best man making one of them near-the-knuckle speeches. He looked to me like he'd been drinking. You know how I warned you about marrying a drinking man?"
"Well, he looked perfectly fine when I saw him," said Rosie primly.
Then,
"Oh, Mum, I had the most wonderful day. We walked and we talked and, oh, have I told you how wonderful he smells? And he has the softest hands."
"You ask me," said her mother. "He smells fishy. Tell you what, next time you see him, you ask him about this cousin of his. I'm not saying she is his cousin, and I'm not saying she's not. I'm just saying that if she is, then he has hookers and strippers and good-time girls in his family, and is not the kind of person you should be seeing romantically."
Rosie felt more comfortable. Now her mother was once more coming down against Fat Charlie.
"Mum, I won't hear another word."
"All right, I'll hold my tongue. It's not me that's marrying him after all. Not me that's throwing my life away. Not me that'll be weeping into my pillow while he's out all night drinking with his fancy women. It's not me that'll be waiting day after day, night after empty night, for him to get out of prison. Mum!"
Rosie tried to be indignant, but the thought of Fat Charlie in prison was too funny, too silly, and she found herself stifling a giggle. Rosie's phone trilled. She answered it and said,
"Yes, and I'd love to. That would be wonderful."
She put her phone away.
"That was him," she said to her mother. "I'm going over there tomorrow night. He's cooking for me. How sweet is that?"
And then she said,
"Prison, indeed."
"I am a mother,"
said her mother, in her foodless flat, where the dust did not dare to settle.
"And I know what I know."
Graham Coates sat in his office while the day faded into dusk, staring at a computer screen. He brought up document after document, spreadsheet after spreadsheet. Some of them he changed, most of them he deleted. He was meant to be travelling to Birmingham that evening, where a former footballer, a client of his, was to open a nightclub. Instead, he called and apologised. Some things were unavoidable. Soon, the light outside the window was gone entirely. Graham Coates sat in the cold glow of the computer screen, and he changed, and he overwrote, and he deleted. Here's another story they tell about Anansi. Once, long, long ago, Anansi's wife planted a field of peas. They were the finest, the fattest, the greenest peas you ever did see. It would have made your mouth water just look at them. From the moment Anansi saw the pea field, he wanted them. And he didn't just want some of them,
for Anansi was a man of enormous appetites. He did not want to share them. He wanted them all. So Anansi lay down on his bed, and he sighed, long, long, and loud, and his wife and his sons all came a-running.
"I'm a-dying,"
said Anansi, in this little weeny, weedy, weaky voice,
"and my life is all over undone."
At this his wife and his sons began to cry hot tears. In his weensy, weak voice, Anansi says,
"On my deathbed, you have to promise me two things." "Anything, anything," says his wife and his sons.
"First, you got to promise me you'll bury me down under the big breadfruit tree."
"The big breadfruit tree down by the pea patch, you mean?"
asks his wife.
"Of course that's the one I mean," says Anansi.
Then, in his weensy, weak voice, he says,
"And you got to promise me something else. Promise me that, as a memorial to me, you're going to make a little fire at the foot of my grave. And to show you ain't forgotten me, you're going to keep the little fire burning and not ever let it go out."
"We will. We will,"
said Anansi's wife and children, wailing and sobbing.
"And on that fire, as a mark of your respect and your love, I want to see a little pot filled with salt water to remind you of all the hot salt tears you shed over me as I lay dying."
"We shall. We shall."
They wept, and Anansi, he closed his eyes, and he breathed no more. Well, they carried Anansi down to the big breadfruit tree that grew beside the pea patch, and they buried him 6 feet down. And at the foot of the grave, they built a little fire, and they put a pot beside it filled with salt water. Anansi, he waits down there all day, but when night falls, he climbs out of the grave, and he goes into the pea patch, where he picks in the fattest, sweetest, ripest peas. He gathers them up, and he boils them up in his pot, and he stuffs himself with them till his tummy swells and tightens like a drum. Then before dawn, he goes back under the ground, and he goes back to sleep. He sleeps as his wife and his sons find the peas gone. He sleeps through them seeing the pot empty of water and refilling it. He sleeps through their sorrow. Each night, Anansi comes out of his grave, dancing and delighting at the cleverness of him. And each night he fills the pot with peas, and he fills his tummy with peas, and he eats until he cannot eat another thing. Days go by, and Anansi's family gets thinner and thinner, for nothing ever ripens that isn't picked in the night by Anansi, and they got nothing to eat. Anansi's wife, she looks down at the empty plates, and she says to her sons, "What would your father do?" Her sons, they think and they think, and they remember every tale that Anansi ever told them. Then they go down to the tar pits, and they buy them 6 penny worth of tar, enough to fill 4 big buckets, and they take that tar back to the pea patch. And down in the middle of the pea patch, they make them a man out of tar. Tar face, tar eyes, tar arms, tar fingers, and tar chest. It was a fine man, as black and as proud as Anansi himself. That night, old Anansi, fat as he has ever been in his whole life, he scuttles up out of the ground, and plump and happy, stomach swollen like a drum, he strolls over to the pea patch. "Who you?" he says to the tar man. The tar man, he don't say one word.
"This is my place," said Anansi to the tar man. "It's my pea patch. You better get going, if you know what's good for you."
The tar man, he don't say one word. He don't move a muscle.
"I'm the strongest, mightiest, most powerful fellow there is, or was, or ever will be," says Anansi to the tar man. "I'm fiercer than lion, faster than cheetah, stronger than elephant, more terrible than tiger."
He swelled up with pride at his power and strength and fierceness, and he forgot he was just a little spider.
"Tremble," says Anansi. "Tremble and run."
The tar man, he didn't tremble, and he didn't run. Tell the truth, he just stood there. So Anansi hits him. Anansi's fist, it sticks solid.
"Let go of my hand," he tells the tar man. "Let go of my hand, or I'm going to hit you in the face."
The tar man, he says not a word, and he doesn't move the tiniest muscle. And Anansi hits him, bash, right in the face.
"Okay," says Anansi, "a joke's a joke. You can keep hold of my hands if you like, but I got 4 more hands and 2 good legs, and you can't hold them all. So you let me go, and I'll take it easy on you."
The tar man, he doesn't let go of Anansi's hands, and he doesn't say a word. So Anansi hits him with all his hands, and then kicks him with his feet, one after another.
"Right," says Anansi, "you let me go, or I bite you."
The tar fills his mouth, and covers his nose and his face.
So that's how they found Anansi the next morning, when his wife and his sons come down to the pea patch by the old breadfruit tree, all stuck to the tar man and dead as history. They weren't surprised to see him like that. Those days, you used to find Anansi like that all the time. Chapter 6, in which Fat Charlie fails to get home, even by taxi. Daisy woke up to the alarm. She stretched in her bed like a kitten. She could hear the shower, which meant that her flatmate was already up. She put on a pink fuzzy dressing gown and went into the hall.
"You want porridge?" she called through the bathroom door.
"Not much. If you're making it, I'll eat it."
"You certainly know how to make a girl feel wanted," said Daisy, and she went into the kitchenette and put the porridge on to cook.
She went back into her bedroom, pulled on her work clothes, then looked at herself in the mirror. She made a face. She put her hair up into a tight bun at the back. Her flatmate, Carol, a thin-faced white woman from Preston, stuck her head round the bedroom door. She was toweling her hair vigorously.
"Bathroom's all yours. What's the word on the porridge?"
"Probably needs a stir."
"So where were you the other night, anyway? You said you were going off to Sibylla's birthday drinks, and I know you never came back."
"None of your beeswax, innit?"
Daisy went into the kitchen and stirred the porridge. She added a pinch of salt and stirred it some more. She glopped the porridge into bowls and placed them on the counter.
"Carol, porridge is getting cold."
Carol came in, sat down, stared at the porridge. She was only half-dressed.
"It's not a proper breakfast, is it? You ask me, a proper breakfast is fried eggs, sausages, black pudding and grilled tomatoes."
"You cook it," said Daisy. "I'll eat it."
Carol sprinkled a dessert spoonful of sugar on her porridge. She looked at it. Then she sprinkled another one on.
"No, you bloody won't. You say that you will, but you'll start rabbiting on about cholesterol or what fried food's doing to your kidneys."
She tasted the porridge as if it might bite her back. Daisy passed her a cup of tea.
"You and your kidneys. Actually, that might be nice for a change. You ever eaten kidneys, Daisy?"
"Once," said Daisy. "If you ask me, you can get the same effect by grilling half a pound of liver, then wean all over it."
Carol sniffed.
"That wasn't called for," she said.
"Eat your porridge."
They finished their porridge and their tea. They put the bowls in the dishwasher, and because it was not yet full, did not turn it on. Then they drove into work. Carol, who was now in uniform, did the driving. Daisy went up to her desk in a room filled with empty desks. The phone rang as she sat down.
"Daisy, you're late."
She looked at her watch.
"No," she said, "I'm not, sir. Now, is there anything else I can do for you this morning?"
"Too right. You can call a man named Coates. He's a friend of the Chief Super. Fellow Crystal Palace supporter. He's already texted me about it twice this morning."
"Who taught the Chief Super to text? That's what I want to know." Daisy took down the details and called the number. She put on her most businesslike and efficient tone of voice and said,
"Detective Constable Day, how can I help you?"
"Ah," said a man's voice. "Well, as I was telling the Chief Superintendent last night, a lovely man, old friend, good man, he suggested I talk to someone in your office. I wish to report, well, I'm not actually certain that a crime has been committed. Probably a perfectly sensible explanation. There have been certain irregularities, and, well, to be perfectly frank with you, I've given my bookkeeper a couple of weeks' leave while I try to come to grips with the possibility that he may have been involved in certain, financial irregularities."
"Suppose we get the details," said Daisy. "What's your full name, sir, and the bookkeeper's name?"
"My name is Graham Coates," said the man on the other end of the telephone, "of the Graham Coates Agency. My bookkeeper is a man named Nancy. Charles Nancy."
She wrote both names down. They did not ring any bells. Fat Charlie had planned to have an argument with Spider as soon as Spider came home. He had rehearsed the argument in his head over and over, and had won it, both fairly and decisively, every time. Spider had not, however, come home that night, and Fat Charlie had eventually fallen asleep in front of the television, half watching a raucous game show for horny insomniacs, which seemed to be called Show Us Your Bum. He woke up on the sofa when Spider pulled open the curtains.
"Beautiful day," said Spider.
"You," said Fat Charlie. "You were kissing Rosie. Don't try to deny it."
"I had to," said Spider.
"What do you mean you had to? You didn't have to."
"She thought I was you."
"Well, you know you weren't me. You shouldn't have kissed her."
"But if I had refused to kiss her, she would have thought it was you not kissing her."
"But it wasn't me."
"She didn't know that. I was just trying to be helpful."
"Being helpful," said Fat Charlie from the sofa, "is something you do that, generally speaking, involves not kissing my fiancée. You could have said you had toothache."
That, said Spider virtuously, would have been lying. But you were lying already. You were pretending to be me.
Well, it would have been compounding the lie anyway, explained Spider. Something I only did because you were in no shape to go to work.
No, he said. I couldn't have lied further. I would have felt dreadful.
Well, I did feel dreadful. I had to watch you kissing her.
Ah, said Spider. But she thought she was kissing you.
Don't keep saying that.
You should feel flattered, Spider said. Do you want lunch?
Of course I don't want lunch. What time is it?